You're listening to KBO Portland 90.7 FM. Next up is Transpositive PDX.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is requesting proposals for a grant writer to provide ongoing grant writing services and application support. This is a one-year contract position for 200 hours, compensated at $25 an hour. Proposals must be submitted electronically to Delphine Crescenzo, station manager at Dell, that's D-E-L, at KBOO.FM. Proposals are due Friday, January 4th at 5 p.m. Responsibilities, background information, the scope of work, and proposal requirements can be found at kboo.fm/grantwriter2018.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive. Transpositive is a monthly program here on KBOO Community Radio that covers the gender non-binary and transgender communities. I am here tonight with Ryan Newby from the Victims' Rights Law Center. Welcome, Ryan.
Hi, Emma. Thanks for having me.
And Ryan, can you tell me, what is the Victims' Rights Law Center? What do you do?
So the Victims' Rights Law Center is a nonprofit law firm. We have offices in Oregon and Massachusetts. And we offer free legal assistance to sexual assault survivors who have civil legal needs as a result of sexual assault. We provide those services in the areas of privacy, safety, education, kindergarten through higher education, employment, immigration, housing, LGBTQ specific issues, criminal justice advocacy, and financial stability. So basically, if a sexual assault survivor is experiencing something they believe might have a legal solution, we would be thrilled to talk to them about whether we'd be able to help them out. Our holistic services, so where we provide full representation in those areas, are focused on the Washington, Clackamas, and Multnomah counties. So sexual assault survivors who live, work, study, or were assaulted in those counties. We also have some statewide services, so T and U visas for survivors of non-intimate partner sexual assault, civil rights certain kinds of education-related claims by sexual assault survivors.
Sorry, I'm going to stop you right there just for a minute, just because I think that's great. I'm really happy to get all of those all of those services, and I can't quite remember all of that, but you do a lot of great work. You really do. And your organization, did it start in Massachusetts? Did it start here in Oregon?
It did start in Massachusetts. So we were founded by a sexual assault advocate who just saw there were these legal needs that sexual assault survivors have that that really nobody was providing. And now we've been in Oregon as well for some time. We provide both direct representation and we have a technical assistance team that provides training and support and research for sexual assault advocates and attorneys nationwide who are serving sexual assault survivors.
That's great. And so you're a lawyer.
I am.
That's awesome. When did you tell me about how did you get into law? How did you become interested in law?
Well, that's a good question. So I've been practicing. I've been a member of the Oregon State Bar for 7 years, since 2011, which is about as long as I've been in Oregon. Mm-hmm. You know, I went to law school for a number of reasons, but I wanted to have more tools for solving problems, and I think I had an idea that it would, even if I didn't want to practice, sort of expand the number of things I could do. Don't know that I would recommend that approach to other folks who aren't sure if they want to practice law, but I have been practicing and I do enjoy it, so it worked out in my case.
Wow, that's great. And are you, do you mind if I ask, are you transgender?
Yes, I am transgender. I use he, him pronouns. And I came to the work that I'm doing now because I've always worked in abuse issues, and I really wanted to do more work for my community. I came to do work that focused on domestic violence because of in part just because I found myself having conversations with friends about things they'd experienced. And I think, you know, in our community, peer-to-peer support is so important, but it's often the only thing we have, and we deserve better than that. We deserve to be able to access the services that we need when we're in crisis, or just when we need services. And I think we're fortunate to live at the moment in a time and a place, in Portland at least, where there are a number of trans and trans-competent professionals. But it certainly didn't look that's not how the landscape looked when I got started. And so I'm very grateful to be able to have a space to do that work and be at an organization that is committed to serving transgender survivors.
That's awesome. Yeah. And you're part of, we're not going to get into it this show, but you're part of the newly formed Trans Law Collective.
Yes, the Oregon Trans Law Caucus. We had our kickoff earlier this month. So it's a bar association, essentially, for trans legal professionals. We're affiliated with OGALA, which is the Oregon's LGBT Bar Association.
And mostly made up of, is it entirely made up of trans lawyers, or are there?
So we have lawyers and people who have law degrees but are not practicing, as well as practicing attorneys. Since I'm not the chair, I don't have the roster sort of in my head.
Yeah, I'm not asking you to speak for the Trans Law Caucus.
But it is an organization of legal professionals, and we're currently focused on having our membership be community members, although there is a National Trans Bar Association that allies are welcome to join and support if they want to support trans legal professionals.
Sure. Yeah. I think that's really exciting. I mean, both the Trans Law Caucus and the Victims Rights Law Center are like two really great organizations that are, you know, based right here in Portland. I mean, I know that Victims Rights has been around a long time. Trans Law is just getting started, but, you know, doing really amazing work to serve the trans community. So let's talk about the Victims Rights Law Center. Let's talk about the work that you do down there. Mm-hmm. And first, I'd like to just kind of start from really kind of like a broad frame. So you serve victims of sexual assault.
Yes.
And you don't just serve trans folks, you serve the whole community.
Right. We serve survivors of all sexual orientations and gender identities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you serve several hundred people a year?
I think that's about right. I will say that I don't know the exact figure.
A lot of people.
But a lot of people. You know, I'm fortunate in that my personal caseload has been of a size where I feel like I'm really able to not feel that sort of sense of overwhelm that I think it's easy to get in legal services. But we also have a really, I think our office is really wonderful and supportive. So we try to provide holistic and creative solutions for our clients, which I really appreciate.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And the kind of community that you serve, it's people who any kind of sexual assault? Does it matter when people, I mean, is it no timeline, anything from something really simple to something really awful?
Right. So our definition in our office of sexual assault is for purposes of screening clients is unwanted touching of an intimate body part. So that's mm-hmm. a much broader definition than some definitions you might have for, like, if you're trying to say, was this a crime, right? That might be a more narrow definition. Mm-hmm. But for purposes of serving folks, we look at, are you a survivor of sexual assault according to that definition of an unwanted touching of an intimate body part? And do you have a sufficient connection to our service area that we're able to provide services? Mm-hmm. What we're able to do for somebody may be limited by timelines. So there has to be a relationship between the fact that this person is a survivor of sexual assault and the thing they want, mm-hmm. right? So it has to be a legal need that has some relationship to the sexual assault. But
so I'm going to ask you this, mm-hmm. not just now, but like several times throughout the interview. Can you tell me how people can get in touch with you? Like, if they're just happening to tune in right now, mm-hmm. they got to go in a few minutes and they want to find out how to get in touch with the Victims' Rights Law Center. How can they get in touch with you?
So we have an intake line that is sometimes we have a person sitting at it, but you can always leave a message and we'll call you back within 2 business days, usually faster.
And what is that number?
And that's 503-274-5477, extension 6. Folks who are trying to get a hold of the Trans ID Project can call me directly. So that's 503-274-5477, extension 5, and they get my voicemail, Ryan Newby.
Okay. So, we haven't gotten to the Trans ID Project yet, but we will get to that, I promise.
Yes.
So the Victims' Rights, we're talking right now with Ryan Newby from the Victims' Rights Law Center, and Ryan helps serve the trans community. He also works with lots of other people, but he works specifically on issues of sexual assault and restraining. You specialize in restraining orders.
I do a fair number of restraining orders. Yes. Uh-huh.
What's that like? Is that?
Well,
I mean, you got to have some oomph in you to do a restraining order, right? Because it's like that seems really scary to me.
I think the restraining orders are really scary for folks who need them. Right?
I mean, I think about in my community, Clackamas, where I live, there's this guy that just got brought up on weapons charges because he gave a weapon to his friend, a man, who then went to West Lynn and murdered his ex-wife, who had filed several restraining orders against him, and then he killed himself. And so they just brought a weapons charge up on the man who provided the original weapon because it wasn't a legal transaction. And it's like, to me, that when I think of restraining orders, that's what I think of. I think of like all the horrible stories I've ever heard of somebody who put out like 15 restraining orders on some abusive ex and they still came back and murdered them.
Well, and that is the kind of thing that I think a lot of folks think of, and it's a fair thing to bring to mind because it is so scary and mm-hmm. it is sort of like, what is the worst thing that could happen? And mm-hmm. that's on your list, right?
Yeah.
And I, you know, my experience in working with survivors of domestic violence in my previous job and survivors of sexual assault in my current job has been that folks come in with a range of fears, and a lot of times that is somewhere on the list, but I want to emphasize that, you know, you can have a fear that is, you know, of physical harm that doesn't quite get to that point, doesn't necessarily mean you don't need protection. And, you know, I think that I just have so much respect for my clients who go through the restraining order process. I mean, I have respect for all of my clients. They all have gone through something horrific, and just finding their way to support services and to legal services requires just a tremendous amount of courage and fortitude.
I just can't imagine. I mean, you must have such a big heart to hear all of those stories. How do you deal with that trauma and that grief?
Well, I'm really fortunate to work at an organization that has prioritized not just trauma-informed services for our clients, which is an incredibly high priority for us, but also a trauma-informed workplace for the folks providing those services. And I don't think that I think that my work requires a lot of skills and that I've worked hard on developing those. I don't think that that it's sort of a superhuman thing. I think that, you know, I got into doing courtroom work because I like sort of dealing with things that come up on the fly, which even when you're very prepared in court, that happens. And because I really like helping people tell their stories. I like figuring out how to tell a story. And
so you help people with their stories. Mm-hmm. That's an important part of the whole legal process, is just being able to get people to speak their truth.
Yes, and I think that for some survivors...
And in a way that works within court.
Yes, and I think for some survivors, figuring out how to tell their story in a way that feels true and honest for them is an important part of healing. And so for some folks who want to get a restraining order and qualify for a restraining order, just the process of going to court and telling their story and refusing to keep their abuser's secrets or their assailant's secrets can be a really profound and significant experience. And so when that's the case, I'm really honored to get to help with that.
Wow, that's great. We're going to take a really quick break, and we will be right back in just a second. We're talking with Ryan Newby from the Victims Rights Law Center. Ryan is a trans man and a lawyer, and we're going to get more into the services that Ryan provides for the trans community and also hear a little bit about Ryan's story. And so we'll be right back. You're listening to Transpositive on 90.7 KBOO. We are back. So Ryan, we were talking a minute ago about the work that you do with restraining orders. Can we follow that thread a little bit further? You do a lot of work with restraining orders in the community for people who have been victims of sexual assault.
Yeah, I would say that that's a significant portion of my work currently.
How did you come to it? And you said that you came to that interest, like, because you help people tell their stories in a way that, like, works in court.
Mm-hmm.
So are the restraining orders, are they effective?
Well, that's a big question. I think that I'd like to break that down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So a restraining order at the end of the day is a piece of paper, literally. It's a piece of paper signed by a judge that gives rules to somebody about what they can and cannot do. And the other thing that it does is that it provides the person who's protected by the restraining order with the ability to call the police sooner than they would be able to without it, right? So normally you call the police when a crime has been committed. So essentially when you have already been hurt or put in grave danger, mm-hmm. roughly speaking, right? Somebody actually has to do something that breaks the law. When you have a restraining order, a judge has found, yeah, this person is dangerous, so maybe the restraining order says they can't come within 150 feet of you. So if they come within that distance, then you can call the police, right? It gives you like a little fence of protection. And basically what that protection is you get to call the police sooner if that fence is breached. And that's important. I don't want to minimize that. That matters. And for some people, that is what keeps them safe and gets them through.
Mm-hmm.
But it also depends on, there's a number of factors that you look at before deciding, is a restraining order the tool here? For some folks, they're going to say, you know what, I know this person, and I know that a restraining order is more likely to provoke them. I know they feel they have nothing to lose, and they'll see this as a challenge. If I have a client telling me that, I trust that person, I believe them, and I say, okay, well, maybe I want to talk about it a little more, maybe I want more information about it, but at the end of the day, I have to trust my clients' understanding of what is going to keep them safe or what they think will not keep them safe. Mm-hmm. And then we look at other options. So a restraining order is one legal tool that can help somebody who has been subject to violence or threat of violence stay safe, but it doesn't fit every single situation.
So I know that you serve both the trans community and the larger cis community, but I'd like to narrow the focus now. And for the rest of the show, I'd really like to spend time talking about the trans community, the services that the Victims' Rights Law Center provides to the trans community, and also talking a little bit about your journey and maybe some of the dynamics that may be hidden or may be visible within the trans community that might need more conversation when it comes to the topic of sexual assault. So one thing I'm wondering, just for starters, is how has the Me Too movement affected the trans community? I mean, are you seeing people who, you know, are coming forth, who are trans, non-binary, who have been victims of sexual assault and have been inspired by Me Too to like step up and like speak truth? Not so much.
Well, I think what I would say is that I think a lot of the popular discourse around Me Too has really focused on the experiences of particular survivors. And I think every survivor has a right to have their story told and has a right to justice and to healing. That shouldn't be reserved for any one portion of the survivor community. But I do think that the dynamics that are being highlighted do typically focus on cis male perpetrators, cis female survivors, and often those survivors are also white and straight, and mm-hmm. in many cases, in terms of what's most popularly seen, economically privileged.
Mm-hmm. Which is how, like, Alyssa Milano ends up getting credited for a movement that she did not start.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And Alyssa Milano has a right to have her voice heard and to justice, and doesn't deserve to be mistreated. But it's also really important to note all of the stories that are not being heard on that broader stage.
Most often. I mean, like so many other things in our society, these stories really started with women of color.
Yes. And I would say that the dynamic that I've seen in my personal experience when it comes to trans survivors and Me Too is a lot of, within my own community, particularly trans masculine folks, seeing folks sort of saying, like, well, wait, we experience as a community sexual assault at these astronomical rates, and when we see this popular discourse about women as survivors of sexual assault, you know, that sort of cis lens really ignores the needs and experiences of trans masculine survivors.
Right. And so in so many ways it kind of, yeah. I mean, I see the calculations going off in my head. So let's like within the trans masculine community, what are the rates of victimization of sexual assault?
So
trans masculine or non-binary?
Yeah. So, I'm drawing this information from my recollection of the U.S. Trans Survey that was conducted in 2015 by the National Center for Transgender Equality, and so it's available on their website. But, you know, what they found in that survey was that approximately 50%, a little more than 50% of trans men and trans masculine non-binary folks have experienced sexual assault in our lifetimes.
That's just, I mean, that's so stunning.
And when you break it
down.
Yeah, and when you break it down further, the numbers get even more horrific. So, you know, if you're a person with a disability, if you're a person who's experienced homelessness, if you're a person of color, particularly if you're Black or Native American, those numbers go up in just really horrific ways. Mm-hmm. And
I'm just so sad to hear that.
Yeah, and you know, I think that when you look at communities that are particularly vulnerable to sexual assault, which is, you know, broadly speaking, women, also bisexual cis women, trans masculine folks, homeless folks, sex workers, those numbers are really unbelievable. And I think that looking at the, I think those figures, that research is so important for several reasons. One is, you know, this question is often asked, why didn't this person report? And first of all, I think that in many cases, it's a disingenuous question, right? Some people really don't know and they really wonder, something bad happened to you, why wouldn't you talk about it? But we can look at, first of all, just prevalence.
There could be so many reasons.
So many reasons.
Safety.
If everybody that you know has experienced sexual assault, you know, what messages do you end up getting? First of all, maybe you think, well, I know so many stories that are worse than this. Why waste anybody's time with this thing that, that really just shouldn't bother me as much as it does? You know, I hear that so frequently.
But down the road, I mean, over the course of your lifetime, that can, like, have so many.
Yeah.
It can have health effects.
Absolutely.
It can, you know, it can affect your income, your
Absolutely.
Social relations, your life
Absolutely.
Choices. Yeah.
Your personal sense of safety, your actual safety. You know, and I think that folk, you know, communities that are particularly vulnerable are often dealing, you know, again, the homeless community, the folks who are living in poverty, folks who are experiencing racism. You may have so many other things that you need to deal with that it's easier to just sort of say, you know what, this is just a thing that happens. It's kind of a cost of being in the world. And I think that for trans folks, there are so many indignities that we experience that we have to decide for just sort of personal mental health reasons. Well, do I want to get into this, or do I want to just decide, you know what, I'm setting this aside for now.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you,
yeah.
I want to ask you a question, and it may be from a perspective of naivete. Mm-hmm. So you'll have to excuse me if I don't understand. And also for the audience, I apologize, but I'm going to get kind of in-house for a minute here, and I'm going to have a conversation that's really trans specific. So I, as a trans woman, don't really understand everything that trans men go through, but I'm wondering if trans men who have been victims of sexual assault, like, at the same time that they're also feeling pressure to conform within a gender binary that, like, enforces a certain set of values with relationship to masculinity, might feel like, you know, an overlaying level of oppression, like, to not report sexual assault, to not even maybe acknowledge it as part of, like, their own transition. Is there any truth to that, or is that just, like, I don't even know what I'm talking about?
Well, I think that that makes sense as a piece of analysis as to whether that's a common set of dynamics for transmasculine survivors. You know, perhaps I think there's, again, it's worth breaking it down a little bit. You know, if you think about, well, what does it mean to report it? So many trans folks have had negative experiences with police interactions. Or if they haven't personally had those experiences, they know somebody who did. And not just sort of routinely negative, but I think we all, if the longer we're in community, the more we hear, like, some pretty shocking stories kind of across the board in terms of institutional interactions. And so, I think that reporting, it requires not just being willing to say the words out loud, but also being willing to put yourself in the position of working with somebody you could report it to. So if you're talking about reporting it to the police, then you have to take into account, like, do I want to tell the police about this badly enough to interact with the police? And so everybody has to, from their own perspective, weigh that. Well, what do they think that's going to look like? Maybe they have a police department that is going to treat them really well, and maybe they know that, and that might make it easier to report. Maybe that police department would treat them really well, but they don't know that. That creates a barrier. Maybe somebody doesn't want to report it to law enforcement but does want medical attention. Do they have a provider that they trust who they can go to? Are they getting routine medical care already? You know, so I think that those access to resources requires sort of multiple levels of analysis. So for me, you know, I have a medical provider who works primarily within the trans community. If I had to have a difficult conversation about a trauma experience, probably that person feels okay for me to talk to in a way that some of my past medical providers wouldn't. Mm-hmm. But not everybody. Not everybody has those professionals in their lives.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then in terms of the pressures, I mean, I certainly feel that dynamic you mentioned about the pressure to conform to a binary, I mean, that resonates for me personally. And I think that, you know, we can't...
I mean, the idea that men aren't victims.
Exactly. I think that we should never discount the role of misogyny in how all of us are forced to sort of navigate transition and navigate life post-transition, whatever post-transition means, to the extent that's a thing, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that... I also just think that within broader culture... This isn't true within all trans community spaces, but within broader culture, the conversation around trans folks and our needs so often focuses on transition-related care and access to really limited set of legal services like, can you change your ID? Mm-hmm. And those things matter. They
Which we're
going
to get to in just a minute.
Yes, mm-hmm. They matter so much. But it also matters that you have ongoing medical care, that if you... get sick and need a specialist, that your specialist is educated, not just your primary care physician. Mm-hmm. It matters that you have insurance and that your insurance will cover the care that you need. Mm-hmm. And those things matter for all people, and they matter for trans folks, but there's specific ways that being trans can make those challenging. And so I think that sexual assault within the community is one of many complex issues that that don't get the attention always from our support services or from our professional services that we really deserve. And so I'm super excited to work for an organization that really cares about that and that prioritizes
very much
trans people's needs.
I mean, just based on the data set that you mentioned from the U.S. Trans Survey, we had Mara Kiesling on in 2017, talking about the 2016 release of mm-hmm. the survey. And, that was one of the really startling statistics that, like, 50% of all transmasculine or trans, I'm not sure how to say it, transmasculine non-binary folks have been victims of sexual assault, which when we were chatting earlier, you said that's almost double the cis rate, like the rate of cis women who are victims of sexual assault. It's about 1 in 4, and with transmasculine, it's about 1 in 2. So
yeah.
there's something going on there, you know.
Absolutely. And, and I just to make that figure for cis folks a little complex, though I know we're focusing on the needs of trans folks, I do think it's important to highlight, and you and I chatted about this earlier, that figure for cis women, it really does get...
Which is startling, too.
It is startling. It's startling and unacceptable. Mm-hmm. But that those figures are for cis women generally, and that when you break it down by race, when you break it down by economic background, when you break it down by things like houselessness, experience of disability, or sex work, those numbers go up
right.
just as they do within the trans community.
Right. So when you're looking at it intersectionally, mm-hmm. it's clear that, women of color are affected disproportionately. Trans folks of color are affected disproportionately. People, yeah.
Absolutely.
So we're talking with Ryan from the Victims' Rights Law Center. Ryan, before we go to break, what's the number that people can call if they want to get in touch with the Victims' Rights Law Center if they need services as a result of sexual assault?
So they can contact us on our intake line at 503-274-5477, extension 6, and folks looking for help with our Trans ID project can contact me directly, 503-274-5477, extension 5.
Thanks, and we're going to repeat those numbers a couple of more times in this show. You're listening to Transpositive on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 here in Portland. We will be right back right after this short break.
I felt all flushed with fever, embarrassed by the crowd. I felt he found my letters and read each one out loud. I prayed that he would finish, but he just kept right on, strumming my pain with his fingers.
One time. And we are back. We're talking with Ryan Newby from the Victims' Rights Law Center. So, Ryan, I really want to switch tracks here for just a minute. We're going to move away from sexual assault for just a couple of minutes, maybe longer. But I really want to talk about the Trans ID project that the Victims' Rights Law Center does. I know that you help trans folks get their IDs. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And not to bring it back to sexual assault, but just to be clear that the criteria for working on, for getting our services, it is still trans survivors of sexual assault who are looking for help
Thank
with
you.
Their IDs.
Thank you for that qualification. I'm sorry.
No,
of course. If I misrepresented that.
No, of course. I just want to make sure that folks are getting in touch with the services that will help them. So the Trans ID Project is very exciting to me. It's one of our statewide projects. So that means that I'm able to help transgender survivors of sexual assault who need legal and financial help getting their IDs changed, whether or not they live in our main service area.
So for the folks in our community who are just cis, who may not, cisgender is a term that we use in the transgender community to refer to people who are not transgender. It's pretty common parlance. So for people who are not transgender, why is it important to have appropriate ID?
Well, so many reasons. One is that it's a safety issue. I mean, I think there's a number of reasons why it matters, but it's a safety issue. So the U.S. Trans Survey, which you were just talking about, had some figures about the frequency with which folks encountered discrimination or assault as a result of showing ID that was incongruous, didn't match what people were expecting, or where IDs don't match each other. And I can't cite the figures off the top of my head, but like the figures of sexual assault, I mean, they were really shocking and unacceptable. And so what we can take from that is that access to appropriate ID is a safety issue for a lot of folks. Second of all, you know, in our current society, we have made showing ID a prerequisite to so many services. I think we could have a whole entire other conversation about whether or not that's appropriate. But the fact of the matter is that's where we are right now. And so if you have to show a driver's license or state ID in order to do whatever it is, pay for your groceries if you're having a really vigilant clerk who's actually checking your ID for your credit card, or if you're trying to purchase something that's age-restricted like cigarettes or alcohol, or you're trying to get into a bar or a club, trying to get access often to spaces that are really vital for your social support, if that's an opportunity for you to get clocked, to get misgendered, to get discriminated against, you know, for some folks, getting their ID for IDs updated can make that less common, and it also, there's some reassurance, right? It's anxiety producing to know that you're going to have that battle or to avoid things that require showing ID.
So that's one of the areas that, mm-hmm. that's one of the many services that you offer to trans folks.
Yes. So our comprehensive services, which we discussed a little bit at the beginning of the program, that are available within the Tri-County area, those are available to cis and trans and non-binary folks. The statewide ID project work is specific to trans survivors.
Does it cost anything to access your services?
All of our services are free. And, you know, to the extent that there's filing fees or other court costs, depending on the service, you know, folks may need to pay those. But the Trans ID Project is really great because we actually have funding to help folks with things like filing fees and the cost of getting those IDs changed. So that's a piece that I'm really excited about. In Oregon, it has gotten a lot easier to do things like change your get a court order, change your birth certificate, change your driver's license. But costs can still be a barrier for folks. And so I'm very excited that our project does have funding on a case-by-case basis to help folks with those costs.
And so you said that part of what you were telling me earlier when we were chatting about what happens at Victims' Rights Law Center is that you have kind of a holistic approach to
yes.
your services?
Yes.
And is that what you mean by that?
So the holistic approach is when we do an intake with a survivor who is within the Tri-County area or whose case has a relationship to the Tri-County area, we don't just ask, what is it you want today? Though, of course, we ask that. We also go through questions to try and identify, does this person have other needs that we can help with, whether or not they're aware that we can help, right? one of the things about being a lawyer is there's a lot of things you can do that other folks who are not lawyers just may not be aware of, right? Because they're not, that's...
You can fly. You can
right, exactly. We can leap tall buildings in a single bound. No.
Sometimes we feel that way about lawyers. And then sometimes we feel the opposite of that way about lawyers.
But exactly. But a big part of my job is to try to understand the barriers that a person is facing and identify for them, well, actually, this might have a legal solution, or this doesn't have a legal solution that I'm aware of, but let me refer you to these other folks.
Yeah.
And because we know that it's so hard when you have experienced trauma to seek out help for that. We don't want to send somebody bouncing around to 27 different agencies if we're able to identify, well, here's a place that should be able to help you with that, or we can help you with that in-house. And so the holistic intake is really geared towards identifying as many of a survivor's issues that may need to be addressed as possible, so that we can really send them out the door with a plan or help enact it.
Yeah, and I think we were talking earlier, and you mentioned that you part of what you do is you train victims to become advocates for themselves and for, you know, to as a form of empowerment. Is that accurate?
Yeah, so I want to be careful about the word advocate just because it can have a specific professional meaning within the assault survivor world.
You.
Yes, it's one of the things about being a lawyer, being very, very picky
yes.
about words.
But a journalist.
Yes, that's definitely true. We both agree that words mean things.
Yes. Words mean things. End of discussion.
Right. but you know, one of the things that is... that it is one of the many things that's so horrifying about surviving a trauma like sexual assault is the way that it can really rob a person of agency. And I think that a lot of the legal process afterwards can also feel that way. And so what we have a survivor-centered model, which is to say, you know, there are certain things we're able to do and not able to do, but our job is to really identify what are your needs, what are your rights, what are your options. It's not to say, oh, you have to get a restraining order. It's to say, well, it sounds like you're worried about your safety because you told me these things about the facts. Based on that, I think that one thing that might be useful is a restraining order. Do you want to hear more about that? Do you want to talk about that today?
Mm-hmm.
The job of the client is to identify their goals and to have those conversations and to make the final decision about what they're actually going to do. My job is to say, well, here's what I think your options are. Here's what I believe I can do for you. Here's the limits on my services.
Mm-hmm.
And to just be as clear and transparent as possible about all of that.
It must be just a relief, though, for people who come to see you. I mean, that must be a great part of the job, is just having people come who really need something, who maybe when they first see you, they're afraid, they're traumatized, you know, they feel disempowered. And maybe some of the services that you do help give them a little bit of hope that they can find some justice.
I certainly hope so. I mean, it is always my goal to have whatever my interaction with somebody is, whether it's just one interview inquiring about services or actually doing a full representation, going through a court hearing, all of that. My hope is that at the end of our interaction, they understand their rights better, have a better sense of how to keep themselves safe, feel that they have options, that they're not trapped, and that they have been able to make their own decisions throughout that the interaction that I've had with them. That's always my goal.
So I'm going to ask you, can I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
Okay. So I'm wondering if anything about your own experience of transition helped inform you and helped you have insight into your role now, you know, at the Victims' Rights Law Center, you know, working on these issues. Can we talk a little bit about your own personal journey?
Sure. So, you know, I've been a lawyer in Oregon. I've been a member of the bar for 7 years. And in terms of my career in Oregon has always included abuse issues, whether that was my volunteer work or, you know, I clerked in the Multnomah County Courthouse in the family law department, you know, for a family law judge, and I saw a lot of restraining orders and all of that, and all of the practice areas that I've had have involved abuse work. And, you know, I really wanted, when I came to my current position, what I really wanted was to have more of my work specifically focus on the needs of trans folks. I really feel that I've been really lucky in terms of the education that I've been able to attain and the work that I get to do, and that I get to do work that I enjoy. And I really want, and I really feel that I've been able to achieve that because of the support of my community. Mm-hmm. You know, and my,
that's great.
Yeah, I've been incredibly lucky. You know, in my experience, I transitioned during law school. I accessed medical and legal transition during law school, and I moved here and really didn't talk about my history. I mean, of course, like most trans folks, it's find outable. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really talk about it, and that at first was a sort of about needing to find work,
blending in, being invisible.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was 2011. Uh-huh. The market was horrible, yeah. And I just didn't want. I like many trans people, was worried about being able to get hired, uh-huh. And so I didn't want there to be something that made that harder. And I didn't. And I needed to break into the community here, and I didn't want something in my story that would make it harder for me to become a part of the community, mm-hmm. the legal community. And, you know, I made those decisions kind of, I thought, knowing what that meant for me. But it is so hard when you make, we all make decisions in our lives about sort of what information to share, how to conduct ourselves that are based on the information we have. We never really know how it's going to play out.
Yeah.
And something,
and it's a kind of self-censorship, isn't
it? It is. And that's exactly right. And I think what I didn't anticipate was that for me, I know that there are plenty of people who keep their trans status as a matter of personal medical history, and they don't, and that
Which
works
totally
for them.
Fine. That's totally fine. Acceptable.
It's totally fine.
There's no judgment about any of it.
No, if that is what is working for somebody, then that is what is working for them.
Yeah.
I think that we should have the right and the agency to tell our own stories and decide what information goes into those stories and what doesn't. And for me, what I wanted was to be able to have relationships that felt authentic to me in terms of the sorts of things that I wanted folks to know about me or that I wanted to be able to talk about. I talk a lot. I don't know if you've mm-hmm. noticed, Emma.
Yeah, I noticed, yes. I've noticed.
Anyway, and I wanted to serve my community, and I found that the pressure once I've sort of committed to keeping my trans status not just private, but less detectable, that meant keeping it a secret, and it really kept me out of community spaces, and it really kept me from having those relationships and of mutual support that I realized are so vital to feeling like an entire person.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
So I'm now open about it because I also realize that in order to serve, it is so hard for folks in our community to trust that a provider is going to treat us like entire people.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, part of accountability and encouraging folks to access our legal services is being open about my trans status, because personally, if I were seeking, when I am seeking services, if I know that a provider either is trans or works very closely within the trans community, it means a lot. And it also means that I can ask around, mm-hmm. and I can get some accountability by looking at their reputation. And so that is part of what drove me to be more open about that in my work.
And in Portland, you can choose for more than just one person, too.
That's right. There's actually a number of trans legal professionals in Oregon. Mm-hmm. There's a number of folks working within healthcare in Oregon.
Which is great.
And it's fantastic.
Yeah, that's nice. So we'll be right back. You're listening to Trans Positive here on KBOO Community Radio. We're talking to Ryan Newby from the Victims' Rights Law Center here in Portland.
Man, I'm out in Texas. Man, I'm out in A-Town. Then I'm up in Chi-Town. Or Miami shutting down. It's that New Orleans. It's L.A. or the Bay. It's New York, Philly, and the whole DMV. I'm a Detroit player. Man, it's North, South, Cat. Ohio, Pittsburgh. Got St. Louis on deck. It's Delaware, Connecticut. It's New Jersey. Got hella this Queens, Brooklyn, and yeah, they rallying. Bronx, Harlem, and Staten Island.
And we are back. Ryan, we've only got about 10 minutes left, but this has been a really important conversation. And I want to make sure that when we sum up this conversation, that we have a chance to get to some of the really important things that the Victims' Rights Law Center does, repeat some of those. And also, if there's things that we missed, I want to make sure to get to those. So first of all, what is the number again of people need to call the Victim Rights Law Center to access services if they've been sexually assaulted?
So our intake line, where you can leave a message any time of day and also hear what our live intake hours are scheduled for that week, that number is 503-274-5477, extension 5. I'm sorry, extension 6. If you're trying to get information about the Transgender ID Project, of course it's fine to call the intake line, but you can also call me directly. My line is 503-274-5477, extension 5.
And those services are free of charge?
Yes, all of our services are free of charge.
And you serve not just the trans community, but you also serve the cisgender community as well.
Correct. We serve sexual assault survivors of all gender identities and sexual orientations.
That's great. That's just amazing work. How many people work there, by the way? I never asked.
So we have two offices, and our Oregon office is 11 folks. So we have so we have 5 attorneys now doing direct representation of folks. So that includes 3 bilingual Spanish-speaking immigration attorneys.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and then there's the we have an attorney who focuses on education-related work, and then there's me. and then we also have attorneys and administrative staff who work on technical assistance, so supporting sexual assault projects nationwide with legal research and sort of trainings and best practices.
How are you funded?
We get some funding from donors. We also get have a number of federal grants.
Oh, that's great.
Yes.
Yeah, that's really important work. Mm-hmm. What's your typical day like? Are you just like sitting in the office getting phone calls? Or?
So I spend most of my time in my office. I might get to have a meeting with an organization that wants to learn about our services or wants to talk about their services. I really love doing those sort of outreach work with other organizations. Sometimes I'm lucky to get to do outreach work within our community. PSU recently had a trans resource fair. We were able mm-hmm. to go there.
We connected there. Yeah.
Yes, and it's such a great opportunity to do things like that, both to meet folks out in the community and to have these sort of cross organizational conversations with other folks that are serving the trans community.
It must be like a challenge, though. Like, I mean, do people come to you where they need to talk about that they've been sexually assaulted, but they just don't know how to even bring it up, even if you're just standing right there in front of them? I mean, how do people broach the subject? How do they get the courage mm-hmm. to make that first call or conversation?
I think that's a great question. I think that, you know, folks, everybody sort of has their own journey. We're typically not the first folks that somebody's disclosed to. Mm-hmm. So often folks get referred by sexual assault advocacy organization, or maybe they've gone to law enforcement or the courts to get a restraining order and then get our information that way. Mm-hmm. Sometimes folks get our information word of mouth. So somebody who's looking for services related to accessing transition-related legal services may get our information because they reach out to somebody else who, like a medical provider or resource center that serves the trans community. Mm-hmm. So I think that for folks who found their way to us, in my experience, often they've already figured out how to at least disclose. They may not know how to talk about their experience. They may not want to talk about their experience. And it's important to note that depending on the service they're looking for, they may not need to talk about it. Mm-hmm. So if the only thing that somebody...
Right, because you're not therapy. You're
not therapy.
You're there for legal representation.
Right. So if,
legal services.
Exactly. So if somebody's looking just for help with ID work, I do have to ask about their sexual assault history, but it's much more limited conversation, and I generally don't need to know specific details, and then we can just move on to the service that's needed. On the other end of the spectrum, if somebody's looking for a restraining order, it's likely that we do have to talk about the assault. They may talk to me, mm-hmm. and it's likely we would end up, if they want to pursue court action, having to have a more detailed conversation because the facts of that assault are likely to be very relevant to the restraining order and may need to come up in court. So mm-hmm. there's a range in terms of how much of a conversation needs to happen about those details.
And the Victims' Rights Law Center is just part of a whole cluster of services that are oriented towards serving people who have been sexually assaulted.
Yes.
And there's also other organizations in town specifically for serving the interest of folks who are trans or gender non-binary who are also victims of sexual assault.
So the Victim Rights Law Center is, we're the only organization that is specifically focused on legal services to sexual assault survivors. There certainly are other legal projects that do serve sexual assault survivors.
Oh, yeah. And I don't even mean legal. I mean, like, in terms of, like,
advocacy.
Therapy.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Medical.
Yes.
You know, I mean, all of the cluster of services that people need if they've been victimized by sexual assault.
Yes, you're so right. And I think we were talking about this just before the break, how lucky we are to live in a time and place when there are, services by and for trans folks or services that are deeply informed by the trans community that are being focused on trans folks. And I just want my hope for us is that that continues to be true in Portland and becomes more true in other parts of the state and other parts of the country, because we deserve no less than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if people need to, people may come to you, they may not know where to go. Mm-hmm. They may have just heard the phone number just a few minutes ago, and they may need help. They may not need help with something legal right now. Maybe they have been a victim of sexual assault, but maybe they need help with housing, mm-hmm. or maybe they want to get into a support group. So, you might point them in a direction, like you might send them to Bradley Angle, or you might find them, housing resources. You can help people with that sort of thing.
So I always do my best if somebody has a need that I cannot meet. I always do my best to identify a resource and help them connect, because we really don't want folks spinning their wheels having to call everyone in town. If we can help them avoid that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And people who have been victims of sexual assault usually have like a whole bunch of things going on all at the same time that like can really make their life total chaos.
Absolutely. And, living in the immediate, somebody may be seeking legal services for it that is really related to an incident that happened in the past. But when you're in active trauma, whether it's because something has just happened or because something has been brought back up, it can just be really hard to go through the steps that are needed to access services, let alone to figure out what services are out there, make a list, prioritize, call them all, call them back. I mean, that level of executive function is really challenging when you're experiencing the effects of trauma. And also there's just a limit to how many hours there are in the day, and people have to work. And
there's also a limit to how many minutes there are in an hour.
Yes.
And unfortunately, we are at the end of our hour. This has been such a great conversation, Ryan. And we didn't even I didn't get into your own personal transition story. I'm so sorry.
No,
I really wanted to
that's
get
fine.
More into that.
But I'm really glad we were able to talk about the needs of trans survivors in the Portland area.
Thank you. So if people want to reach the Victims' Rights Law Center, let's just repeat that number one more time if they want to call.
Yeah, so the intake line for the Victim Rights Law Center is area code 503-274-5477, extension 6.
Is there an email or website or something?
Our website is victimrights.org.
Okay.
And you can read about our services there and get our contact info. And again, if you're looking to access information about the Trans ID Project, you can call me directly. And that's area code 503-274-5477, extension 5.
Thanks, Ryan. It sounds like the work that you guys do really makes a huge difference in the community. I mean, just based on the amount of funding that you get and, you know, the number of lawyers that are really committed to this work. Do you think you'll be doing this for is this your career?
You know, I really love my job, and I'm so lucky to have wonderful colleagues and so lucky to be able to do this important work. And I really hope we are making that difference. I think we are, and I really am proud to be contributing to the really excellent work that my organization does.
Great. Well, thank you. You've been listening to Ryan Newby from the Victims Rights Law Center. This is Transpositive here on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM here in Portland. And we will see you next month for another episode of Transpositive. Thank you and have a good night. Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Next up is Calculated Conversation with David and Ken.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Vintage Ska and Rock Steady with Keith and Tex on Saturday, December 22nd from 9 to 11:30 p.m. at the Jack London Review in Portland. Keith Rowe and Philip Texas Dixon are most known for their rock steady hits Stop That Train, Hypnotic Eyes, and Tonight. This event features Keith and Tex as well as Winston Flames Jarrett and DJ Zach Doe for this holiday concert. Again, that's Vintage Ska and Rock Steady with Keith and Tex on Saturday, December 22nd from 9 to 11:30 p.m. at the Jack London Review, 529 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
So this is Christmas.
On Monday, December 24th, Prison Pipeline hosts will feature your holiday messages to your loved ones in prison, as well as greetings from prisoners for those on the outside. Email your message to kboppc@gmail.com or snail mail your holiday message to KBOO Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Then tune in on Monday, December 24th at 6:30 p.m. Again, that's kboppc@gmail.com or mail